Welcome to the Calder Farmstead.
Now the Icehawks back out to center in transition. Carlson with Quenneville 2-on-1. Right wing Carlson from the Quenneville scores.
Here to chance for Perrin.
Five scores! On the faceoff!
Up it's Hemminger. Go back to Werenski. Has it. Shoots one. Bounces off a man. 5 seconds left. Werenski. Another jam on the shot. Turning and firing.
It's gone in overtime. The Bears breaking out. Right side with Bear. Looks like cutting to the net. Bear will score!
And here are your hosts, CeCe and Sean.
Hello and greetings from the Mile High City of Denver, Colorado.
And Copenhagen, Denmark.
Welcome to the Calder Farmstead Podcast, episode number 89 for Wednesday, March 9th, 2022. If you're hoping for a podcast featuring a guide to reorganizing and preparing your farming tools for the springtime, we are not going to be much help. This is American Hockey League Podcast, and my name is CeCe Hockley, the AHL editor of Full Press Hockey.
And I'm Sean O'Brien from StatsTrack and the AHL's only league-wide analytics guy.
And I know how much he loves me saying it, but he's kind of a big deal. Big deal. Big deal. Thank you very much for tuning into the show.
And if you're new to hearing CeCe and I talk about hockey, we're going to recap some of the matchups from the past weekend in the American Hockey League for you. We both watch a lot of AHL games and are going to talk about what we see when we watch the film, as well as use some advanced stats to help us break that down. If that's new to you, you may want to head over to our podcast feed or YouTube channel, wherever you're listening to us from, and check out episode 0. It's all the way at the bottom, but it is down there, and it's a short primer on some of the stats we're going to be talking about, as well as how we view what's important on the ice. So if you're new to some of the more advanced hockey stats terms like PDO or the point shares model, or newer hockey terms like controlled zone entries, go check that out so you better be able to pick up what we're putting down. I promise it's not that nerdy or technical. It's only 20 minutes. And let's be honest, you wasted 20 minutes trying to figure out how Shaq saves money on gas. You'll never get that time back. So next time, why not spend a little more time with us talking hockey?
Why you got to do the big Aristotle dirty like that? That's what I got to say.
The big Aristotle can't do math, CeCe.
To quote the Shaktus himself, he's like the Pythagorean theorem. He has no answer.
The Pythagorean theorem has an answer. That is literally, it's...
Exactly. He did say that. He said his offense is like the Pythagorean theorem. There is no answer or something like that. But anyway.
The answer is to foul him. Hack a Shaq. I don't know anything about basketball, and I know send him to the free throw line was the answer. But let's get going here.
Correct. Let's get going. Let's get started with the weekend pick'ems. And yours truly was not here for last episode. Courtney Bauman filling in once again, her second time this year doing so, doing a excellent job. I did go back and watch it. Yeah, I'm not just going to... You know, you gotta do my due diligence and pay attention to the episodes that I'm not involved in. Anyway, back to the pick'ems. So, how did Courtney do in her first opportunity picking some games with you, Sean? Well, she was holding up pretty well. I was tabulating it. She held up pretty well until the last part of Saturday and into Sunday. She finished with 17 correct picks of the 32 games. That is a 53.1% positive pick rate. But Sean, you seized a very convincing dub this weekend. Give him the Hulk Hogan, brother. 23 of 32 correct. That is a 71.9 positive pick rate. Shawnee, you even beat the model this week. You put down the machine. You killed the creation that you, well, the thing that you created, but not really. The model went 21 of 32, so just a couple picks shy of what you did, Sean. 65.6% positive pick rate. And, of course, we won't get into overall records or anything because you did not face off against me. But anyway, but nicely done. Way to pick over two-thirds of those games.
Yeah, you know, sometimes you just pick up the good vibes better than other weeks. I will not try and say that I had any kind of magical clairvoyance this weekend when we made picks. I just kind of went with a little bit of a blend of, you know, how I saw the tea leaves and, you know, the output the model gives. So it's good to beat. I mean, Courtney did. I mean, 53.1 would have been a W for, you know, whoever made that higher rate in most of the weeks we pick games. So, like, it's not that Courtney did a bad job. She actually did pretty well, but I, you know, just was feeling the tea leaves a little bit that weekend. So come out with a dub. The fact that we both I beat the model is more the impressive thing, because that thing has won most of these pick matchups.
That's so, correct.
Yeah. Let's get into it here. Enough stalling, as Rucker Hauer calls it. But we are going to recap the weekend here. Let's kick it off.
Yes, we are. And just to wrap up the Pick'em segment, having just watched Robin Hood Men in Tights, for you, Sean, it's good to be the king. All right. So Lehigh Valley and Charlotte, we're going to start with the Atlantic Division, as we normally do here on the Calder Farmstead. Their weekend series was a Friday-Saturday two-game set, 7:05 p.m. at Lehigh Valley for both of those games. Sean, we've got some goals to cover, and I think you're the man to do it. So let's begin with the Friday matchup.
14 goals. Let's get to it. Isaac Radcliffe on Friday collects a puck behind the checker's net. He catches Scott Wilson puck watching, dishes to Matthew Strom in the slot. Strom one times it past Spencer Knight for a 1-0 Phantoms lead just over 2 minutes into the game. After making a diving breakup of a pass in the slot, Wyatt Wiley is stripped of possession by Alexander True. True works the puck to the point for Matt Kierstad, who fires a prayer from distance. His prayers are answered, though, as it deflects off Cam York and in. Game tied at 1, just 4:15 into the game. Just over 3 minutes later, the Phantoms penalty kill gets caught trying to apply pressure along the wall as Owen Tippett gets the puck to the goal line for Scott Wilson, who one-touches a pass to Zach Dalpy at the faceoff circle. Dalpy one-times it low blocker past Felix Sandstrom, 2-1 checkers. Henry Bowlby picks up a loose puck in his defensive end and gets a controlled zone exit. He goes one-on-one with Linus Hogberg. Bowlby turns the corner on Hogberg, cuts to the slot past Isaac Radcliffe, and roofs one over Sandstrom's blocker, 3-1 checkers, 17:54 left in the second. Chase Prisky picks up a clear in the neutral zone and easily walks past the Phantom's forecheck, gets a generous gap from Igor Zamula as he enters the offensive zone, cuts to the slot. Prisky wrists one from the high slot that goes bar down past Sandstrom, 4-1 checkers, 12:05 left in the second. Cam York catches a pass flat-footed at the blue line, but is able to get a shot off intended to be tipped by Strom. Strom is able to get the tip on it and get it past Spencer Knight, 4-2 checkers with under 2 minutes left in the second period. Cole Schwind hits the empty netter to make it 5-2, which is your final. The checkers win this one 5-2 on Friday. On Saturday, on the power play, Cale Fleury fakes a slap shot on the point before dishing to Cole Lind on the half wall. Lind one touches a pass across Royal Road to Owen Tippett, who walks in and snaps one past Pat Nagel, 1-0 checkers, 13:26 left in the first period. Under a minute later, Henry Bowlby gets a controlled zone entry and drops a pass for Cole Schwind. Schwind can't catch it as he's hit to the ice by Zamula. Dennis Chalowski steps up and fires a slap shot from the top of the circle that beats Nagel low blocker side. 2-0 checkers. On the power play, Alexander True makes a move to the net and gets a grade-A scoring chance that Pat Nagel stops. Nagel somehow isn't able to cover the rebound. A net front battle ensues, and it comes to Chase Prisky as he backhands one into the net to make it 3-0 and chases Pat Nagel just under 2 minutes into the second period. Owen Tippett dances around 2 forecheckers in the neutral zone before getting the controlled zone entry. He fakes a slap shot, circles below the faceoff dot, and catches the Phantoms puck watching as he hits Cole Lind across Royal Road in the slot for a one-timer goal. 4-0 checkers, 16:15 left in the second period. Pass the slot by Tanner Lisinski is broken up but not controlled by Charlotte. A loose puck battle at the net front ensues, and Cal O'Reilly swoops in, picks up the loose puck, and backhands one past a sprawling Decord. 4-1 checkers with 17:42 left in the third period. Adam Clendenin gets stripped on a pinch attempt that springs the checkers for an odd man rush. Hutsko backhands a pass across Royal Road to True. Sandstrom makes the save, but Carter Robertson hustles in to tap in the rebound. 5-1 checkers with 13:13 left in the third period. A rebound is chased down by Wyatt Wiley on the half wall. He collects a loose puck and fires a shot from the outside that Morgan Frost tips from the side of the net past Decord to make it 5-2 with 11:14 left. That would be the end of the Phantoms' comeback bid. Checkers sweep the weekend with back-to-back 5-2 wins.
Well, let's talk about your guys' picks and see what you tried to predict going into this series. Courtney accurately called it Charlotte sweep, and you, Sean, said you were going to take Charlotte in both, but you thought that it was more likely that than not that they would split, but you didn't want to play guessing games with which game Lehigh Valley would win. So your words, you said you'd cop out and take the checkers, and that proved to be the good choice. And the model echoed you guys. You all three were on the same page. Checkers sweep. Checkers were a 53.7% favorite in both games. On to the team level takeaways. Two games with the exact same score, 5-2. I imagine they probably didn't look the same, though. So, Sean, enlighten us. How did Charlotte manage to take these two games?
A couple of ways. Number one, they forechecked the Phantoms to death and owned the neutral zone for most of these two games. Anytime the Phantoms got control of the puck in their own end, the Checkers were there putting pressure on them and forcing either bad passes in transition, glassing out clears, or dump and chase down the ice. Second is that unlike the Phantoms, the Checkers were prepared for forechecking pressure. It was rare for the Phantoms forecheck to get home this weekend, and it seemed like Charlotte's defensemen always looked cool, calm, and collected when fielding dump-ins and getting transition going the other way. They by and large made clean passes, executed breakouts smoothly, and knew where the puck was supposed to go based on the pressure that they read before they had to make that decision. Third, the Phantoms did manage to gain a moment or two with the puck, and their defensemen threw away a lot of those pucks. What I mean by that is they would go glassing out when it wasn't necessary. They'd play dump and chase when they could have worked for a zone entry. They'd fire pucks up the wall blindly when they could have made better choices. This was a lot more prevalent on Friday than Saturday for the Phantoms, but it was present too often in both games for Lehigh Valley. The Phantoms also looked sloppy on the penalty kill on Friday, which is very unusual for them. They gave up a lot of easy zone entries to Charlotte and in general didn't defend Royal Road or the slot all that well. They looked much improved on Saturday, but was still not up to their normal standards in either game. So that was one of the big problems that they had as well over the weekend. Overall, though, this was a fairly dominant weekend sweep by Charlotte, who looked in control of the flow of the game for nearly the entire six periods of play. Charlotte was the more talented team here going into the weekend. On top of that, they looked better coached and better prepared than the Phantoms did. They executed their game plan exponentially better. And when you do that, a weekend sweep outscoring the opponent 10-4 seems like a pretty foregone conclusion.
Right, right. Well, two more things we need to talk about from this weekend before we shift over to the individual skaters that stood out for one or both of these teams. First is the Phantoms goal that was waved off on Friday. I'm going to pull it up here. And there we go. That way you can still see our faces. But Shawnee, you've got this this green circle right here. Looks like a stick there in the crease. What's your reasoning behind that?
So we didn't want to try and bring up the video here because it actually, when we've done that in the past, doesn't stream very well. It's real scratchy. So this singular frame here that I screen capped pretty much will help anyone who watched this game, saw this goal. When I saw it live, was like, oh yeah, that's goaltender interference. Ryan O'Reilly basically just falls, right on top of Spencer Knight while Spencer Knight's in the crease. That's obvious goaltender interference, no goal. I saw like the first couple shots of the replay, didn't really do much to change my mind. And then I saw this overhead shot and I realized something about it. Mm-hmm. That's actually Jacob Friend's stick, not Cal O'Reilly's. O'Reilly falls because he's going forward and trips over Friend's stick that's pinned between, Friend's holding it on one end and Knight's skate on the other. And he basically becomes kind of fulcrum is the physics term here, where he right over. But what initially trips Spencer Knight initially makes contact with him and kind of gets him, off balance and falling isn't O'Reilly like falling into him. It's Friend's stick right there. Mm-hmm. And that to me raises the question of like, all right, Cal O'Reilly's not pushed in here. He kind of falls because of his own momentum going against, the stick, but he doesn't initiate this contact. The Checkers defenseman kind of does here. The stick is what makes first contact with Knight and sets him off balance. Cal O'Reilly falling on top of him is kind of just icing on the cake here. Mm. Is this like, I actually don't have a good answer for this. To me, I think this maybe should have been a good goal. I'm not positive like how I feel about this though. Like, yes, O'Reilly still makes contact in the crease. Does he initiate that? He doesn't initiate the contact with Knight, but he does make contact with Knight. Now, if Stick isn't there, does O'Reilly fall in the night? Probably not. So this gets a lot murkier for me, and I don't really know the answer, but it doesn't seem like from watching the broadcast that this was reviewed from the video. Like, it looks like the refs kind of just made a call, stuck with that call, and they called no goal right away. And like I said, when I saw it live, I was like, oh yeah, that's duh. But it took me this replay angle going, you know, slow as hell for me to see, like, that's Friend Stick that makes contact. That's what knocks Knight over initially. And then O'Reilly falling on top of him really didn't change the outcome of what happened. I don't think anyway. Is that still goalie interference? I honestly at this point don't know.
You know, and watching this segment of the game film from above, like this, like you said, it appears that Friend actually ties up Cal O'Reilly. Like he gets the stick and he kind of wedges O'Reilly's stick against the ice, or, you know, it's difficult to see from an upward camera angle, but it almost seems like he kind of incapacitates O'Reilly, and then the stick goes underneath. You can see it go underneath the pad as you have it circled there of Knight, Spencer Knight. And then the sequence of events is just Cal O'Reilly, you know, he's tied up and he kind of falls over and his elbow hits Knight in the head. And that's probably all the refs saw. So they're like, of course, no goal. It's goaltender interference. But I mean, when your own guy is tying up another guy in the crease and incapacitating him to the point where he runs into your goalie and you are the cause of that,
I don't know. Like,
it's murky. Yeah, I agree with you.
I think this is one where, and again, I don't know if the refs actually looked at, you know, the iPad or the, you know, tablet. Sorry, Apple, not a sponsor of the show, but, you know, and saw these video replays and made the decision based on that. From what I could see from and hear from the broadcast, it didn't look like they did, and it didn't sound like they did. It sounds like they basically made the call on the ice, huddled up to confirm the call, went and explained it to both benches, and then ran the play, you know, continued the game. Mm-hmm. And I think if they would have stopped and looked at this, we may have had a different outcome here. Like, I'm not saying for sure this goal should have counted, which was my take when we talked about, you know, walk-off Milot a few weeks ago, which I thought that goal should have counted. Here, I think it's a lot less clear. Like, this seems much more ambiguous to me. And I could see it going either way. I could see the argument that, you know, O'Reilly still makes contact with Knight in the crease, and that's good enough. Or that Friend is the one that initiates contact, and that's a friendly fire goal, basically, and the goal should count. I can see both arguments having merit here. I have no idea. If I were the ref in this game, I think my first call would be to the AHL and ask them, like, all right, is there enough security in the building to get me out of here? And if no, then maybe I call it a goal. Yeah, because like this is a 4-2 game here with, as you could see in the, you know, timer, a little under 13 minutes left. So this makes this a one goal game with plenty of time left to score. Like, yeah, Charlotte's still a big favorite here to win this game. But like, they're maybe 20-25%, you know, to Lehigh Valley to pull this out, maybe 20 ballpark from, you know, my having studied some of these live models in the NHL and stuff like that. You're in the maybe like high teens, low 20s for what your percentage to win would be here in a one goal game with that much time left. So like, this does change the game materialistically. Like, the Phantoms never, you know, really make too much of too much noise after this. So like, I don't know. I certainly think that there is room for debate there. I'd be curious to hear others' thoughts. But I think it's at least close. I don't have a good answer.
Yeah. It's murky for me too. So we're both on the same page with that one. Yeah. Second piece of business here that I wanted to bring up is that Jackson Cates injury. Sean, what did you think of the hit? Are there any updates to his condition after he went hard into the boards?
It's obviously very unfortunate what happened to Cates. I'll speak for you, CeCe. We both hope he makes a full recovery. You never want to see players get stretched off the ice or off the field or basically ever. Anytime you see a stretcher, it's always... And most cases, it seems like they put you in the stretcher for preventative means. because, you know, you never want to be the person that's like, oh yeah, 99% sure spine is fine. And then you, you know, cripple a person for life because you can put them on a stretcher or whatever. So like, it's unfortunate. It's always terrifying to see that come out because we always assume the worst. Last I saw was from Phantom's broadcaster, Bob Rotruck, on Twitter, that Cates had all of his tests come back normal and he was released from the hospital. He did stay, I think, overnight for, you know, additional tests and like that, but he's been released. I'm obviously not a medical professional, and if the last 2 years on the internet has taught me anything, it's don't pretend to be a medical professional when you are clearly not. I will not speculate further on his condition. All I will tell you is Bob Rotruck said he was released from the hospital. That's the Phantom's broadcaster. I imagine he's probably in the know. Mm-hmm. But as for the hit itself that sent him into the boards, there's nothing to see there. Cole Lind initially makes contact with Cates around the hash marks. That's like 30-ish feet from the end boards. It's not a dirty hit. Lind didn't do anything but make a standard defensive play there. The speed Cates was moving at, I mean, he was going at full speed to try and, you know, create a shorthanded scoring chance there. That's what caused him to go into the boards with that amount of speed. And you can't implement rules where players can't be hit from a safe distance from the boards because they're moving too fast. That's not realistic. It's not realistic to say to Jackson Cates, don't skate that fast. It's an unfortunate injury, but clearly an accidental one. Routine plays like this rarely have bad outcomes that require, you know, this level of medical attention happen, but sometimes they do. It's unfortunate, but there really is nothing that you can be done about it. We just hope that Jackson Cates is okay, but this was not a dirty play. There was nothing more than, I think, freak accident here, and I see no reason to really try and speculate further that Colin should see discipline or a penalty should have been called or anything like that.
When you're playing a game at the professional level or at the, you know, not the top, but even at the AHL level or anything like that, when speed is involved, especially when you have danger blades attached to your feet, you know, it's like, you're going to go fast. You're going to make contact with somebody. Even those clean hits, like, people can get injured. People can hit the ice. You know, it's just, especially coming down the ice as you're trying to make a play on the puck. And yeah, like you said, I mean, I couldn't have said it any better. It's just an unfortunate situation that, you know, somebody got hurt. Thankfully, you know, they are, you know, on the mend, as it were. So yeah, it's just, it's going to happen at this level. It's going to happen at the NHL level. You just can't avoid it. So,
and I've had injuries like this happen to me. I mean, not nearly as severe where I'm getting stretchered off the ice, but I've had moments where, like, I'm coming in on a scoring chance, you know, and I don't skate anywhere near the speed of Jackson Cates, you know, got hit and from, you know, a completely reasonable distance from the boards, but just went flying into the boards, basically tried to put my glove through my chest, which didn't feel great. And yeah, it's unfortunate, but it does happen on occasion. I've seen a dude in, you know, beer league, you know, get checked, lightly pushed in a similar spot when he was flying down the wing, get hit from that in, you know, that general area and break his leg, you know, crashing into the boards 25 feet later. It's like, yeah, was it maybe kind of a shitty push there? Sure. But he was really far away. Like, you can't be blamed for the break at that point. Anyway, let's move on. Let's wrap that one up there.
Yeah. We'll jump on over to the individual player analysis. Who stood out to you at the single player level for these teams?
Not shocking. Logan Day was healthy scratched for the Saturday game because he was capital B bad on Friday. About half of my game notes highlighting Phantom's mistakes from Friday's game feature him in some way, shape, or form. Logan Day has offensive talent, but his ability in his own zone has been not very good in the best of times. And in the worst of times, it's like, what are you doing? There were some just truly like wild ass mistakes that he made in Friday's game, including one where he pivoted to defend a transition. He pivoted the wrong way. He pivoted away from the puck carrier. And I saw that. It was like, yeah, if you can't see my face and you're listening, just imagine me shaking my head doing like the Jackie Chan meme thing right now.
Yeah, the
very
fusion.
What? There are a lot of those faces I made on Logan Day plays. So not shocking to see Ian LaPerriere decide that he was getting the yank from Friday's roster into Saturday. A bunch of other guys did too, but he was clearly the most egregious in my mind. Wyatt Wiley, not that far behind. Morgan Frost made some plays this weekend, but a lot of them were from the perimeter. He really seemed to struggle to get anything going on the inside. And given his talent level, that's at least mildly concerning and something to monitor going forward. I'm not overall concerned. I'm very much willing to just chalk this up to a bad weekend for him and not a one that I would say is indicative of his ability, because I don't think it is. He made dangerous plays from the perimeter, which is good, but still struggled at times to get anything from the perimeter to the inside. And a couple of cases too, where he caught pucks on the inside and just could not make things happen with them. So something to at least monitor going forward, but nothing that I would be overly concerned about, but not a great performance from him this weekend. But still, when he has the puck on a stick, he is the most talented player on Lehigh Valley's roster right now. And I don't think it's terribly close. On the Charlotte side, Jeff Merrick said on 32 Thoughts that the thinking was that the Flyers brass was at this Charlotte Lehigh Valley game to watch Owen Tippett. Apparently it was a full house, according to Merrick, for the box there. But the basically the thinking was they were there to watch Owen Tippett, who is the Panthers prospect for a potential Claude Giroux trade, because I think that was one of the destinations he said he wanted to go. Was like there, Colorado, and like one other place.
Minnesota, I want to say.
That would be, I don't remember if that was right. That would be surprising. But okay. I mean, he would fit well in Minnesota. But I think if you're going to go someplace, you want to go to a team that's like a, oh yeah, they're a cup favorite. I don't think Minnesota fits that category. Like they're a good team. Don't get me wrong. I like the Wild. They've won me a bunch of money this year, but like Colorado and Florida are on different levels, I think.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
But if the Flyers brass are there to watch Owen Tippett, if that was the case, they certainly got an eyeful. Cause let me tell you, I can see why he hasn't found a space on the Panthers roster because, well, if you haven't watched the Florida Panthers this year, they're loaded on offense. They are a disgusting offensive team. But he's a quality prospect with a lot to like, and it was on display this weekend. If he's part of Charlotte's playoff run, which is not a guarantee because he does not fit Florida's timeline right now. Florida is in win right now mode, and Owen Tippett is still a probably NHL player on some teams this year, but a, you know, one that needs maybe another year or so of seasoning before he's a full-time NHL player, I think. And that is not Florida's competitive timeline. It's win right now this season. So I could see him being part of trade bait. But if Charlotte does have him for this run and he somehow manages to stick around past the trade deadline, that's a huge weapon for Charlotte. They have a lot of talented guys on offense, but they don't have a lot of just pure weapons. And Owen Tippett is a weapon. Speaking of weapons Charlotte does have, Alexander True was another one I was really impressed by this weekend. It wouldn't shock me to see him full-time with the Kraken next season. I'm surprised he's only gotten 8 games with them. I would have thought, you know, given how bad the Kraken are, they would be like, eh, screw it. We're just going to play, you know, whatever kids we have, see what we got in them, because who cares? This season is lost. But they are not taking that approach. They have left him in Charlotte by and large for the last little bit here. And he plays like he has really developed to be a 200-foot player. I feel like I remember when he was in San Jose with the Barracuda, he did not have kind of those more pronounced defensive aspects to his game. But I was really impressed with his ability to make impacts in all 3 zones. His skating is still a little concerning to me, but I think he'll be good enough to, you know, play at the NHL level, given the fact that he is not the fleetest of foot. I also am really hoping, and we talked about this on Friday a bunch, that Florida does figure out at the trade deadline what it's doing with Spencer Knight, because he was on it Friday night. And this spot start and back to Charlotte thing can only be really good for his frequent flyer miles, and that's about it. I have to imagine at some point he gets tired of this kind of up and down, up and down. And we talk about yo-yos all the time. And I think with goalies, there's a little bit more understanding. At least that's my perception of it. Reality may, you know, differ. I'm not a goaltender, but it does seem like goalies tend to understand. They're like, hey, we need a guy to start a game, and then we're sending you back a little more, a little bit better than what happens when it happens to a skater. But this up down for him, it's got to at some point you know, have an impact on his psyche. And that kid is good. He is a future NHL goaltender in all probability. I try to never say that, you know, a guy is 100% locked for the NHL, because man, that has blown up in my face a few times, because prospects are weird. You know, 23-year-olds flame out all the time by 26 in the most competitive hockey league in the world. But he certainly looks like it at times, even in when he's played in the NHL. So I really hope they figure it out, because Spencer Knight needs to stay somewhere a little more permanent and get comfortable, put his feet up. I hope it's Charlotte, because that'll be more fun for us. But he certainly seems like he's earned his keep in Florida. I don't know why they keep sending him back, but here we are. That just is,
Go ahead.
I was going to wrap us up, so please. No,
I was just going to say, just say no to Spencer Knight's yo-yo. I mean, that's the thing. You yo-yo prospects, and you're going to you play stupid games, you win stupid prizes, as you oh so often say on the show. I figured I'd borrow that from you, Sean.
Oh, no, that was a very good use of it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think that's it for us, though, for this weekend between the two of them. But that's the rearview mirror. Let's look forward. CeCe, where do these teams go from here?
Well, we'll start with the Checkers. And as we're recording this on Tuesday night, Charlotte is in Texas, and Charlotte emerging with the victory 3-1 over the Texas Stars this evening. So Charlotte is starting the week off on a good note over the woeful Texas Stars. They're going to finish a back-to-back with the Stars on Wednesday at 7 p.m. Central, not including Tuesday's result. Well, I guess Charlotte's now 3-1 against Texas this season. Nope, so we are going to include Tuesday's result. No, that's
I updated that. They're now 2-1. That is with Tuesday's result.
Oh, that is with Tuesday's result.
Sorry. Didn't get to edit the document quick enough.
Jeez. Come on, Sean. You're not setting me up for success here. No, you're good. You're fine. We do our best to set each other up for success. So stuff falls through the cracks. I'm not going to hold it against Shawnee, but I will hold it against Texas, because they've lost 4 of 5 going into these. Well, now one game with Charlotte. Is that stat updated too?
No.
So they've lost 5 of 6 now.
What's that?
So they've lost 5 of 6 now against Charlotte then.
Not 5 of 6 against Charlotte. They've lost 5 of 6 in their last 6.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Yep. They were 4 or 5 going into those two games.
Yes.
Sorry for the confusion, everybody. I mean, when games are getting played on the day we're recording, it tends to muck things up. So thanks for sticking with us. Charlotte rounds out a 4-5 at home, hosting the Springfield Thunderbirds. Springfield will have a big rest advantage, as they don't play during the week, whereas these will be games 3 and 4 of the week for the Checkers. Charlotte is 1-3 against the T-Birds this season. Springfield starting to pick up a little bit here, 7-3 in their last 10 games played. Kick it over to the Phantoms. They lost tonight, which is Tuesday, against the Hershey Bears. They were shut out against Hershey 4-0. They host Laval and Hartford this weekend on a Friday-Saturday matchups, respectively. The Phantoms and Rocket haven't played this season. The Rocket are 5-5 in their last 10, and the Phantoms are 3-2 against the Wolfpack this season. The Wolfpack are also 5-5 in their last 10. So those two seem like they could go either way.
That is it for our time here in the Atlantic Division. We're going to take a break. After the break, we will get to Rochester and Belleville. If you're just here for Lehigh Valley and or Charlotte, thank you for stopping by. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you're listening to us from, so you get episodes in a timely fashion. You also should check us out on social media. We have some fun there. We throw out jokes about Sean Avery every once in a while, about how a shopping cart made it closer to an NHL comeback than he did. If you want to check us out on social media, you can follow us on social media, and links to all of that, plus links to where you can listen to us as a podcast or watch us on YouTube, plus a couple other things, are linked at our Linktree page at linktr.ee/TheCalderFarmstead. We're going to pay some bills, run some ads. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
We jump on over to the North Division after covering Lehigh Valley and Charlotte in the Atlantic Division. And it was Rochester and Belleville in this weekend series, Friday and Saturday, 7 p.m. at Belleville. And Sean, you got to have all the fun. You brought on Susie Cool from the Rochester Americans organization. And again, going back, watching the program, very insightful. So kind of disappointed
she had fun this weekend too. She made her NHL debut on the Sabres broadcast.
She did. I did see that tweet. We did retweet that on the Calder Farmstead. So Yeah, no wonder. No wonder she couldn't make it tonight or last night as we were recording, because yeah, she kind of had an NHL debut.
Bigger things, you know, happening than our dumb little podcast here.
But hey, I mean, to say that, oh yeah, she was on our podcast, you know, on
we
on
springboarded Thursday. Her right to that Sabre stardom. Yep. That's exactly what happened. That's our story, and we're sticking to it.
The good old TCF springboard, you know, it's just, it's going to become a thing now. But anyway, let's talk about the Amerks and the B-Sens. Again, Shawnee, we've got some goals to cover. I was about to say to recap and to cover and recover. No, we're just going to go ahead and recap them before I butcher the English language any further. Go ahead.
All right. Friday, to get it started, a blown coverage by Brennan Warren gives Michael Delzato a free shooting lane. Delzato shoots intentionally wide, and the rebound off the back wall is grabbed by Cole Reinhart and put past a scrambling Arendelle, 1-0 Belleville, with just under 11 minutes left in the first period. Linus Weisbach pulls up on a rush and risks a prayer in the general direction of the net. His prayers are answered as Igor Sokolov accidentally deflects it past Gustafsson to tie the game at 1 in the last minute of the second period. On a 3-on-2 rush, Jake Buccini takes it wide and fires a pass across Royal Road that two Amerks defenders fail to cover. He finds Andrew Agostino on the back door, and he taps it into a wide open net. 2-1 B-Sens just over 3.5 minutes into the third period. 38 seconds later, Arttu Ruotsalainen picks up a loose puck in the defensive zone, deeks past Mark Kastelic, walks through the neutral zone, deeks past Lassie Thompson, and then fires a snapshot over the glove of Gustafsson to complete the coast-to-coast highlight reel goal and tie the game back at 2. Regulation doesn't give us a winner, so we head to overtime, and Arttu Ruotsalainen is not done yet. He gets a short pass from Jimmy Schulten, speeds past Logan Shaw, and rips a shot high blocker past Gustafsson. 3-2 Amerks is your final on Friday. Saturday, a lot more goals were scored here. Kevin Mandelize rims around a dump-in that gets past Oskari Laaksonen at the point. Logan Shaw scoops it up and is off to the races on a shorthanded breakaway. Shaw fires a shot low glove side past Ukko-Pekka Luukkonen to make it 1-0 B-Sens with 6:33 left in the first period. Just over 2.5 minutes later, Belleville gets another shorthanded breakaway. This time it's Cole Reinhart, and he snaps one high blocker past UPL. 2-0 B-Sens. Michael Delzato fires a shot from distance that rifle stops, but Jake Lucchini wins a battle over Brandon Davidson at the net front for the rebound, and he bats it in. 3-0 Belleville with 1:16 left in the first. Peter Tischke takes a pass from Ryan Scarfa with a point and skates it down the wall and into the corner. Tischke attempts what looks like a pass to Linus Weisbach at the net front, but it gets deflected and sneaks under Kevin Mandelize for the Amerks goal, 3-1 with 14:28 left in the second period. At the point, Jacob Bernard-Docker one-times a clearing attempt from the Amerks towards the net. Matthew Wedman, who is skating to the net from the corner, gets a stick on it and gets it past Ukko-Pekka Luukkonen, 4-1 Belleville with 11:31 left in the second period. Off a face-off win by the Belleville Senators to start a power play, Andrew Agostino puts a pass right through Arttu Ruotsalainen across Royal Road to Mark Kastelic. Kastelic, with the catch-and-release wrister, beats Ukko-Pekka Luukkonen over his glove for the power play goal, 5-1 B-Sens. On a 5-on-3 power play for the Amerks, Jack Quinn picks up a puck stopped by Rifle on a clear by the Senators. Quinn goes coast-to-coast and snipes a shot over the glove of the Mandalesian, 5-2 Belleville with just over 12 minutes left in the third period. On the same power play, the Amerks work the puck around the outside to Jack Quinn. Quinn hits Peterka in the bumper spot for the one-timer. The shot's broken up by Lucchini, but it dribbles to Brett Murray at the net front, who puts it past Mandelize, 5-3 Belleville. Nick Pastryvov scoops up a rebound at the side of the net and circles behind. He finds Nick Boca out in front, and Boca puts it past a sprawling Mandelize to bring the Amerks within one with 8:32 left in the third. Roby Järventie plays the puck up the wall and finds Michael Delzato. Delzato hits one-times it high glove past Ukko-Pekka Luukkonen to pour some cold water on the Amerks' comeback attempt, 6-4 Belleville, with just over 4 minutes left in the third. With the goalie pulled, Ethan Prow plays catch with Jack Quinn at the half wall. Prow walks the return pass a few steps, before firing a wrister that gets through traffic and beats Mandelize clean to bring the Amerks back within one with 1:42 left in the third. That would be the end of the scoring, though, as the Senators hang on to win it 6-5.
Well, I tell you, Belleville almost messed around and found out against Rochester in that second game. But let's get to our picks. Courtney picked Rochester to sweep. Obviously, the latter game flew in the face of that. Sean, you said if Quinn was healthy, which he was, Rochester wins Friday. Otherwise, Belleville would take both. And lo and behold, Rochester took Friday and Belleville took Saturday. Let me tell you something, brother.
Hey, save that for later.
Oh, sorry. That was Hulk Hogan. You got to go a little gravel. Yeah. Let me tell you something, brother.
Okay. Hogan. Okay. I can hear now.
All yes. Right. All my Hulkamaniacs. Yeah. Sorry. I can do Hulk and Macho. You got a discerning ear. Anyway, the model picked Belleville as 59% favorites in both games. That number was also without Jack Quinn. Yes, there is that qualifier there.
Yeah, that is a huge qualifier because, shockingly, Belleville without one of the best players, Rochester without one of the best players in the league is not nearly as good a roster.
No. So, two games that had similar vibes to them, both one goal affairs. Shawnee, what were the big takeaways from this weekend series between Belleville and Rochester?
Similar vibes in both games indeed, and a similar vibe to a lot of the series we cover this weekend. One team that's been picked clean of a lot of talent by injuries and NHL call-ups got outplayed in transition by a team that forechecked better and controlled play. This is a theme that you have already heard once if you're listening from beginning to end, and will hear again. This appears broadly in about 3/4 of our coverage this weekend. But in both games, it felt like Belleville's game plan of turning the neutral zone into sludge and forcing their opponent to play dump and chase or turn the puck over was executed pretty well, and we've seen that from them before. Belleville dominated possession in both games, but I don't think Friday's game was as bad as the shot counter showed. Belleville also didn't do a whole lot with the possession that they, had predominantly throughout the game. Dominating possession is great and all, and it's an important aspect of winning hockey games, but it's kind of implicit that you turn that possession into meaningful scoring chances, and Belleville really didn't do that. On the Amerik side, they did not get much of anything going with their forecheck this weekend and let Belleville own the neutral zone for the first and second period of both games, it felt like. They got at least a little bit back to even in the third period of both games, but by and large, it felt like Belleville had the ice tilted their way because of their forecheck for the first two periods of both games. They had some stretches in those four periods where it felt like they controlled possession, talking about the Amerks, but it was short-lived, and they were driven mostly by the Amerks' top six. That was the other big story of the weekend here, and one we could see coming on the Amerik side from a mile away. Their bottom six is made up of ECHLers, and it looks like it this weekend. Just not a lot of effective or efficient play from the bottom of the roster, and that's not terribly shocking. That was a problem going into the weekend. We talked about it with Susie. It showed up again this weekend, and as we've said a couple of times here in different words perhaps, but if you replace the Stallions with donkeys, you can't expect the wagon to go at the same speed, and yeah, that's a little bit of what happened here, especially too, that Belleville's playoff roster, assuming they make the playoffs, is going in all likelihood to look very similar to the team they currently ice now. The Amerks roster will not, and we did talk about that on Friday, but those differences were apparent here. And I don't feel like should this be the first round playoff matchup for the North in that kind of preliminary cash grab, that this is going to play out in a similar fashion. I expect Belleville to do the same thing game plan wise, but I think the Amerik will be better able to handle that with the talent that we expect them to get back from Buffalo and expect to get healthy between then and now. I will say, I thought the biggest difference between Friday's and Saturday's games were the goaltending though. I don't think Aaron Dell ever really looked on per se. He looked like he was struggling to move efficiently at times and fell on his ass trying to make a save a few times. And yeah, being a goaltender and a game, you're going to fall on your ass once or twice just making saves, but he seemed to more like lose his balance and fall on his ass as opposed to doing so in the act of saving a puck, if that makes sense. Regardless, he gave the Amerks a chance to win, even if he maybe didn't look the sharpest, he still gave them a shot to win that game. Saturday's game featured goalies who very much were not on their best game. A lot of low percentage chances seemed like they found their way into the back of the net here. Ukko-Pekka Luukkonen, aka Rifle, really was not on his A game for him this weekend. But lucky for him, neither was the Mandalesian. So this ended up being a little bit more of a Scoro affair than you would have thought. But not a game to remember from either of them. All in all this weekend, though, it saw Belleville execute its forecheck really well, but not do a ton on offense in terms of high danger chances. It saw the Amherst miss a lot of guys like Marish and Malone and Krebs and Samuelson and those kind of guys. And like we said, you can't replace the Stallions with donkeys and expect the wagon to go the same speed. And that's pretty much what we saw from the Amherst this weekend. I'm still not pressing the panic button for them. If this is what they play like when everyone's back and healthy, or at least a majority of them are, yes, it's panic button time. We are not there yet. They are still comfortably in a playoff spot. I'm not concerned.
All right. Back to the individual players. And of course, we'd be remiss if we didn't bring up a returning Jack Quinn. Quinn making the score sheet this weekend, 3 points in the two games played. Sean, tell me a little bit. How did he look to you?
Mostly fine. I mean, he's an Irishman, so peaking in March is what we do. But he's still an offensive weapon, and in some spots, he looked like he didn't miss a beat. In others, you could tell there's maybe a little rust to shake off, but I'm not really concerned about that. This is something that you would expect him to, you know, have anyway from that kind of layoff, and expect him to shake off in due time. It would shock me if in 2 weeks from now, he didn't look identical to what he was prior. And he hasn't gotten a lot of time on the ice, and he's been off for a bit. So, like I said, to be expected. I will say I did see one improvement in his defensive effort. I thought that looked better. I think I only saw one moment from him on the weekend where he kind of quit on a back check. There was one, I want to say Friday, where it was a shorthanded chance going the other way. And like he hustled through the neutral zone and then kind of got to the top of the circles and either just ran out of gas or, I guess, kind of, you know, decided that he was not going to be able to make it in time to make a play and then just kind of coasted. I'm not really sure, but like that was the only time in which I can really point at Jack Quinn and be like, yeah, you were like three strides away from making a good defensive play and just quit. And again, you know, having not been up to speed, practicing and getting ice time and stuff like that, that could have just been I am legitimately too tired to continue skating in that moment. But we've seen that previously from Quinn in other games, and we have called him out on those moments. And I was surprised to not see that from him this weekend. I'm glad that that's part of a game that is leaving. But there also was a surprising thing that he was out there killing penalties and did look good-ish doing it. Didn't make any serious mistakes that I saw. And I remember watching him kill penalty going out there for the PK and thinking, oh, this could be tricky, but I'm not sure if he was going out there to kill penalties just to get his ice time up, shake off, you know, advance the rust shake off as it were, or if this was part of a development plan for him to be someone who kills penalties. He's not a bad defensive player in that he knows by and large what he's supposed to do. You know, defensive responsibilities of a winger are incredibly simple and straightforward. It's when you have to be a center and play center that your defensive responsibilities and the places you have to go and be and defend and do are exponentially more complex. But if you're a winger, it's not that hard. So it's never been that he doesn't know what to do or doesn't understand the coverage or anything like that. His defensive problems have always been effort-based because he'd seemingly rather save his energy to do the offense. But Quinn, by and large, put that effort in this weekend on defense. And that plus, you know, some shaking off rust with timing and so on, I expect to be back to being the difference maker he's been all season in no time. As for other guys who stood out this weekend, Oskari Laaksonen was bad. A lot of lazy plays from him in all three zones, but especially on defense and in transition. It's not what I'm used to seeing from him, so I'm okay, you know, giving him a pass on it as a fluky weekend or whatever, but he can't be this bad in the future or there are going to be problems because he was capital B bad this weekend. Not quite Logan Day bad, but very much in the same ballpark. On the Sens side, really liked what I saw from Lassie Thompson. A miscue or two here, there. He got walked, on one of Arttu Ruotsalainen's goals, which, yeah, that's not a great look for him, but the rest of his time on the ice, I was happy with. So that I can, you know, let that one go for, that, you know, a benching kind of moment, but like, okay, what did you do wrong? You know what you did wrong. Don't do that shit again kind of thing. But I like how his game overall is developing. He definitely seemed a lot more gun shy at the beginning of the season, and that's starting to go away. He's starting to kind of feel more comfortable with the pace and the speed of this game. And I think that's very good. The usuals for Belleville were good too. Lucchini was good. Sokolov was good. You know, pumping their tires in games they were obviously very good in seems a little redundant. We like to try to do a little more deep dives than that. Mark Kastlik continues to impress me as well in some future. And I've liked what I've seen from Mark Kastlik too. He's been a surprise this year. I really didn't think too much of him going into the season, and he's really shown a lot more than what I thought previously of him and changed my opinion a little bit. So when we do season previews or if we deep dive his game in the future, it's going to see a bigger uptick than what we've said about him prior. I think a lot of the improvements he's made haven't just been flashes in the pan, but something that he's worked on to improve his game, and good for him for that. In some future episode, we will probably get into why Michael Delzato is in the AHL, but God forbid he ever learns his lesson. He'll at least be a playable asset to an NHL team because he's too good for this league. This is a pace of play that is beneath him, and it shows. But he is here for a reason in Belleville, and maybe sometime in the future we'll get into that, but it's not shocking. But he is still too good for this league.
Wrapping it up here, let's finish out the Eastern Conference and tackle where the teams go from here.
Well, Rochester heads to a 3-4. Wednesday, they're hosting Laval at 7:05 p.m. Gotta love those 5 minutes. The Amerks are 3-1 against the Rocket this season, and the Rocket, as we detailed previously, are 5-5 in their last 10. Friday, they host the Crunch. The Amerks are 4-5 against the Crunch this season, a number that I was surprised by, as I thought, you know, for most of the season, the Crunch have been kind of not that good. And the Amerks have been pretty decent, so that was a surprising record to look up and find. Syracuse is just 5-5 in their last 10, as they still seem to be a team that looks good but can't get out of its own way at times. Saturday, the Amerks head to Utica. They are 3-5 against the Comets this season because, well, I'm pretty sure the Comets have a winning record against every team. But the Comets are just 6-4 in their last 10. They have started to find, you know, when you don't have a PDO of 108 every game, the games are a little harder to win. On the Belleville side, Belleville has their own 3-4 to play. Wednesday, they are hosting the Bruins at 3 p.m. I haven't looked this up, but I'm assuming that's a school day game or something like that. Otherwise, Wednesday at 3 is an odd time for a game. I'm assuming pretty much zero people will be there, but okay. Belleville has won the only meeting between the two this season. Providence is 9-1 in their last 10 and very quietly catching fire. Belleville heads to Manitoba after that for a weekend series against the Moose. The Senators are 0-2 against the Moose this season. The Moose still struggling a little bit. They are 4-6 in their last 10.
Alrighty. Before we head on over to the Western Conference, let's take a bit of a breather, shall we? And after our brief respite, we are going to get to the Milwaukee Admirals over in the Central Division. And if you're just here for Rochester and Belleville, we want to thank y'all for stopping by. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you're listening to us from, so you get episodes in a timely fashion. Also, check us out on social media. It's where we put together those memes and send them out there, and hopefully you get a good laugh out of it, because we sure do. But links to our social media, as well as links to our YouTube channel and popular podcast links, can be found at our Linktree page at linktr.ee/TheCalder Farmstead. If you don't know how to spell the Calder Farmstead, I don't know what to say. How did you get here? I don't know, but it's up in the corner right here. If you do need some spelling tips on the Calder Farmstead. Anyway, enough about that. Let's take a deep breath. We'll head on over to the Western Conference in the Central Division to cover Milwaukee right after this.
And we are back, and we are headed over to the West Coast. We're going to cover the Milwaukee Admirals weekend. Recap that for you. They played two games this weekend, Friday at Texas, Sunday against Grand Rapids, both of those in Milwaukee. And we brought along a friend to help us break that down. We are so happy to have back friend of the show, Eric Dunay. He is a writer for the Super Bowl Nation blog about the Nashville Predators called On the Forecheck. He does their kind of subsection about their prospects that looks at the Milwaukee Admirals and beyond, known as On the Future. Welcome back to the Calder Farmstead, Eric Dunay.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk about the Admirals.
Absolutely. before we dive deep into what happened this weekend, let's remind all the good folks at home the goals that were scored and what they looked like. CeCe, walk me through the goals recap here.
Sure. We'll start with Friday as Texas came to town against Milwaukee. First period, Jeremy Davies passed up the right side to Tommy Novak. Novak gave it to Igor Afanasyev in the middle while crossing Texas's blue line. Afanasyev, a couple strides and a wrister later, and hey, the ads are up 1-0 at 1:20 in the first period. Very early there in the primary regulation frame. Towards the end of the first, Tommy Novak, there's that name again, he wins a 50-50 puck battle with Ciccone along the Texas blue line. Two-on-one breakout with Rocco Grimaldi, Rocco's Modern Life, a Novak to Grimaldi railroad pass and a flip shot, and the ads have a 2-0 lead at 18:56 of period number one. The Stars finally get on the board, though, as Riley Damiani breakout passes to Alex Petrovic. In the Texas zone, Petrovic backhands to Jared Rosberg along the boards in the ads end, and Rosberg gets a Milwaukee defender to bite before walking it in and scoring 2-1 now Milwaukee at 13:58 of the second period. On a resulting power play, just moments later, Anthony Lewis fed a short pass to Joel Esperance on a gather-and-shoot goal to tie the game at 2-2 at 15:01 in the second period, just 63 seconds apart for those two goals. Grimaldi then fakes a shot on the next goal scored on the left-wing side before passing to a wide-open Jeremy Davies along the goal line. He walks it in uncontested. No defenders get him, and he scores at 4:50 of the third period. Another Milwaukee PK, another Texas power play goal. On the Russian, Jordan Kawaguchi saucer passes to Damiani Royal Road. Damiani using that he fast speed and his fancy stick work to score the equalizer 3-3 at 9:37 in period number three. And then I go too far on the outline here. Again, this will be an editing moment. Sorry about that. Yeah, my cursor was way down the outline and I pressed down and that wasn't good. Okay.
No worries. You're the one that's got to edit it, not me. So
that's very true. 3-2. We go through a scoreless overtime before heading to the shootout. Delandria and Lewis are denied for Texas, as is Novak for Milwaukee. But Grimaldi and Glass are not, giving the ads a 4-3 victory. After the skills competition, they emerge with the dub on Sunday. Or on Friday, rather. And going into Sunday, rather, we have no scoring through the first and most of the second periods. And then Cole Smith and Jimmy Huntington in the latter portion of the second period come into Grand Rapids zone for a 2-on-2 chance late in the second. Smith takes it in and wrists it past Grand Rapids goaltender Calvin Picker to make it 1-0 Milwaukee at 18:13 of period number two. Griffins respond rather expediently. A give and go between Taro Hirose and Riley Barber in the neutral zone leads to Barber accelerating into Milwaukee's zone, dodging a check at the blue line. Barber gives a very slight dangle before shoot, rebound, shoot, another, yeah, couple chances. Goal pass Devin Cooley, tied 1-1 at 19:11 of the second period. Third frame, Grand Rapids carries that momentum from the last period. Barber in a multi-skater tie-up puck battle behind the Milwaukee net. He darts the puck in front to a waiting Hirose for the score. Count it at 1:36 of period number three. 2-1 Grand Rapids. Over the halfway mark of the frame, Grimaldi puts a shot on net on the power play. Pickard makes the save, but Donovan corrals the puck with his skate, kicks it over to his stick for a backhanded goal at 12:38 of period number three. Now in dramatic fashion, right on the nose with 1 minute left in regulation, a Cody Glass shot is deflected in front by Captain Cole Schneider to lift Milwaukee to a 3-2 lead, and that would be your final. The Admirals take two games in 3 days against two different opponents.
Yeah, and we made some picks in your absence, CeCe. Me and the model got it right. I am bought in fully on Admirals 21-22 season turnaround, Volume 3, Version 2, Final Edit 3. The model put them as pretty big favorites, 54.3% over Texas, 55.1% over Grand Rapids. Courtney had them over Texas, but thought that Barber would be the difference there. To at least give Courtney a little bit of credit, Grand Rapids sure came real close to it. So
Yeah.
Courtney only gets one out of two. Me and the model both take them both. Let's talk team level takeaways here. This is definitely a lot closer of a weekend than I think we would have thought for Milwaukee. So they do sweep the weekend. They do take care of business in a couple of one goal affairs. We highlighted the penalty kill being a problem for the Admirals heading into this weekend. What did you see from the penalty kill for Milwaukee on Friday and Sunday, CeCe?
A couple words here. Not good. That's what I saw. It was not good. Tell you, the previous 10 games before this weekend, Milwaukee's penalty kill, their rate was killing 23 of 36 power plays. For those unwilling to do the math at home, that is a 63.9% kill rate. And that, my friends, is atrocious. While they killed off the one and only power play that the Griffins had on Sunday, the Admirals killed only 3 of 5 power play chances that Texas had in the game on Friday, sticking around in that low 60s PK percentage range. And yeah, again, it's awful. And I did pay attention to last episode in spite of my absence. And I noticed you mentioned three main things about the Milwaukee PK that were not good. Changing out the rover in the check press. You mentioned that wasn't the greatest or the smoothest. D-men slow to get in shooting lanes and to get physical. And identifying the where and who of the passing lanes instead of just kind of having their sticks out there, you know, just randomly in lanes, not necessarily the main passing lanes. So the defenders on that first Texas power play goal, they gave Les Bronze way too much breathing room in the slot. So, and they also struggled with changing out the rover. Imagine that. So of the two defenders in front of Ingram, you know, defending the goal there, one played the skater below the goal line and the other just kind of hung out in the low crease. I mean, he wasn't really there to put a lot of pressure or to even be physical on Les Bronze, because you can't be physical with somebody when you have massive gap issues there. So yeah, hung out in the low crease until it was too late. Les Bronze corralled the puck and just wristed it by Ingram. And I think Ingram actually got screened as well on that with those two Milwaukee skaters in front. Now, the second Stars power play goal from Friday, all four of Milwaukee's penalty kill guys were focused in on Jordan Kawaguchi. And so Riley Damiani, being the speed demon that he is, he, as Kawaguchi comes through the neutral zone, Damiani comes behind the defense, jets in. Kawa saucers the pass to Damiani, and he turns on the Jets, receives the pass, gets a primo chance, primo goal. And in my journalistic opinion, it is time to mix up the penalty killing lines there in the Brew City. So that's enough for me. Eric, you've been covering this team all season. You've seen the penalty kill woes and the special team woes in that regard. What say you? What do you think could help turn this PK around for the Ads?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even sure it's a matter of switching up the personnel. I think that first answer is taking less penalties, which I'll give the team credit. You know, at one point earlier this season, I think they were for a couple of days, the most penalized team in the league, and they dropped below Hershey or Iowa for a moment. And they've slowly crawled their way back from that position they don't want to be in. I'm sure they're still in the top 10, but I think it's like sixth or seventh by now in total penalty minutes. You know, taking just one, you know, non-offsetting minor against Grand Rapids is certainly an improvement. But early in the season, one of the things that we saw so frequently was, you know, anyone who watches the AHL knows that Milwaukee's not the fastest team out there. I think outside of a few players like Rocco Grimaldi, you know, not the quickest group of forwards or defenders, but a lot of just lazy plays, a lot of lazy stick plays, you know, hooks, reaches, slashes, all that stuff. So I think that has certainly improved. But on the other hand, like, this is a physical team, and Carl Taylor wants them to be physical. And you saw that against Texas. You know, Cole Smith gets an elbowing penalty. You know, Mitch McClain's taken his fair share of penalties this year for getting a little too physical. And, you know, ironically, I think the player who was most at fault on that Les Bronze goal, Josh Healy, you know, took his own penalty later in the game. And that's certainly been a problem for him. So I think the first answer is not taking as many penalties. But you're right. You know, one of the things that has been a huge problem for them, both on the penalty kill and at even strength, is they're just letting anyone permeate the middle of the ice in the defensive zone. That play on the first goal where both defenders looked completely lost. I mean, we saw it again in I think it was the second goal against Grand Rapids. And that was at even strength. The blue line on this team has its issues. And if I were Carl Taylor, I would not be putting Josh Healy out on the ice really at all, but he continues to get a lot of penalty kill minutes and I think the results are going to continue to go the way they are. As long as you have someone like him or someone who's, you know, I think a better player, but more inexperienced like Mark Del Geyser getting a lot of penalty kill minutes.
And it seems like they've had such an inconsistent defensive core this year. Like when you see like the good games from them, you're like, oh my God, they have, you know, four top four defensemen in the AHL without breaking a sweat. But like they have these games where it's like, it's almost like they're doing tequila shots in the locker room before the game among the defensemen. Cause it's just like, it looks like a vastly different group. Some games where they just have these off nights where it's like, instead of, you know, having maybe a B minus kind of night where it's still passable, they have like A plus games, A games, A minus games, and then like D's, and very few in between where it's like, even their games that are kind of, you know, a little, an off night here or whatever, are just like, they're not just off nights. They're off the deep end nights. They're a lot of burn the film nights. And that's the kind of consistency that they've been having just all season. And to see that, you know, defense doesn't kind of just leave your body when you become shorthanded or when you become 5-on-5, like the playing power play offense versus 5-on-5 offense is different. But even though the dynamics are different for penalty kills, like a lot of the same principles apply. And if you're a bad penalty killer, you're probably a bad defense or a bad defender at 5-on-5 and vice versa. There aren't too many guys who can just kind of snap out of those moments. So seeing that they've struggled 5-on-5, to see that bleed over to the penalty kill as well, it's not that shocking, but it does become a point where it's like, all right, if they switch up the lines, and I don't think that that's necessarily a bad idea. It's more of just like, I don't know who you put on. I don't know who the answer is, instead of just basically shaking things up for the sole purpose of shaking things up. And stupidly, that works sometimes. Sometimes you need to give, you know, guys a fresh look that maybe don't necessarily deserve it, but the ones that are on there, you know, deserve to take a seat for a while. It also seems too, like, as long as if you block like a shot every other game on the penalty kill, coaches will keep putting you out there because they just see one big shot block and not a lot of tiny details you're screwing up. And at least that's what it seems like to me. I'm not in those coaches' room meetings, but like, it does seem like the guys who end up making like bigger, splashier plays can screw up the small ones that lead to goals just as well. And they still get the time out there. And that's, I don't know, maybe a coaching inefficiency. And that's not just on Carl Taylor's staff. That's across the league as well. But it's been a frustration to watch what is a talented team on paper do stuff like this all season. And it's part of the reason why, you know, it took me a while to kind of get back on board with Milwaukee getting it right again, because I felt like I'd been duped so many times. But I will give them credit, though, at least a little bit, in this sense of like, neither of these games, from what I can piece together here, were A-plus games for the Admirals in terms of execution and, you know, all systems go. But they managed to pull 4 points out of it. And this is definitely a moment earlier in the season where they would have pulled 0 or maybe 1 point out of it. So at least, if nothing else, like, they're able to kind of have games like this where it's not pretty, but they're still pulling out wins. And like, yeah, Texas has not been great this year. Neither has Grand Rapids. But like, you still need to win games and pull out ugly wins. And I think that is kind of what has been a big separating part for them from earlier in the season to now. It's like the A-plus games are still there, but now it seems they're at least able to scrap together enough in bad games to at least get to overtime, which, I mean, I hate loser points vehemently, but if I were a coach in this league and they were awarding me loser points, I'd be happy scraping to overtime in bad games. Let's switch over, though. Let's talk about some individual players here. Courtney and I spoke about the awesomeness that is Rocco Grimaldi and what he brings to the team. We gave him some MVP praise, even though I think there is basically a less than 1% chance he wins the MVP this year, mostly because of how people vote for that award, or at least how we assume the shadow government that elects the MVP votes for that award. I'm going to guess that his weekend went well, though. But who are the other guys in Milwaukee's roster that were noticeable, good or bad, helped the team get dubs, or maybe kind of almost let some of those games go to overtime for you Friday and Saturday, CeCe?
Well, I'll tell you, first and foremost, I did look up that stat against for Milwaukee's penalty minutes, so we'll backtrack a little bit there. They are currently fifth in the league in PIMS.
That's personal growth right there.
Yeah, personal growth. 55 games played, 692 PIMS. San Diego is ahead of them by two. They have 694, but they have played 10 less games. So go ahead, Shawnee.
I'm going to let you answer this, the player question I asked you. I'm going to look up time shorthanded per game because I think that's like PIMS. If you take, you know, a couple of bunch of fighting majors, there are misconducts. Yeah. Nobody cares.
There were like three coincidental penalties in the Grand Rapids game.
I will look that up while you talk about some individuals here, CeCe.
I will. And oddly enough, another sidebar, Milwaukee didn't have any power plays against Texas. Texas had no penalties. No shorthanded chances, that is. So anyway, moving on to those individuals. Sorry, I just wanted to address that real quick. So first, something I noticed on Friday, you know, having three of your regulars return for various reasons on Friday night, you know, bringing them Milwaukee, kind of like you said, if they can scrape together and win those B minus C games, those are the kind of gritty games you need to get you back into your regularly scheduled playoff contention. Matt Tennyson, you know, coming back after the call up to Nashville, Mark Del Geyzo returning from a 4-game layoff due to taking a puck to the head. Ouch. And Matthew Olivier skated for the first time since January 19th. And that game was also against the Stars. He missed 16 games in between those Texas matchups. And I tell you, Tennyson, he got a handful of shots on goal this weekend, but the leadership on the ice, obviously, the locker room, you know, presence of a playmaking vet, no doubt appreciated by Milwaukee. Del Geyzo also didn't really pop off the stat sheet this weekend, but something I noticed about him, the way that he exhibits patience and it kind of bleeds over to his teammates in regards to setting up the plays, corralling the puck behind the net, you know, letting the guys get in position before pushing into the neutral zone. It's noticeable. You know, I noticed that a number of times, you know, from behind Ingram, from behind Cooley, forging into the opponent's zone without losing the Admiral's collective head, you know, crossing again that blue line and pushing into the opponent's zone. Olivier, he showed flashes of brilliance. It was kind of a hit and miss sort of thing, quite literally. You know, he did hit the crossbar late in the first period against Texas, and there were some gasp-inducing kind of rusty moments. He had a bit of a defensive lapse late in the second against the Stars that could have very well been a goal against. So Olivier did bring that as well, kind of the, you know, woohoo and the dynamic in between the two. But nevertheless, you know, Olivier, he had the assist on the first goal on Sunday night from Smith, and it set the tone late in the second period. Finally, you know, got Milwaukee going. And eventually they won the game. And last but not least, yes, Grimaldi played wondrously as well. Goal and assist on Friday, assist on Donovan's power play goal on Sunday. And as Sean put it last episode, well, in many episodes, Rocco Grimaldi has been playing angry because he deserves and he should be playing at the NHL level up with Nashville. But he gonna be pissed off in a Milwaukee Admirals uniform, and he's going to ball out, as we say here on the Calder Farmstead. And, you know, he's definitely Milwaukee's MVP for sure. But, you know, like you said, Sean, less than 1% chance maybe of an AHL MVP nod. But I mean, with the stats that you presented last time, I would give him consideration if I was a voter, but I'm not, at least not currently.
I mean, I think he deserves consideration. I wouldn't give him the award personally, even on my ballot, but he would be on my ballot. What about you, Eric? Anyone individually stand out for you, good, bad, in between this weekend for the ads that you want to highlight or lowlight? Or
sure. I'll make a quick note on Tennyson, too. When him and Del Geyzo have been in the lineup together, they've been paired together all season. So it was good to see them back together. I think Tennyson's really done a lot for him. I love Mark Del Geiser. I think he's extremely underrated in this prospect pool. I think he's what, and this is nothing against David Ferentz, because I think they're both exciting prospects, but Mark Del Geiser is everything people think David Ferentz is, just a little smaller. I'm really excited to most nights when he's in the lineup. I was worried that he would take his first year in the AHL a little too cautiously, and any chance he gets, more so than everyone on the blue line except for Jeremy Davies, he's skating the puck out of the zone and up the ice himself, which I love to see. But in terms of a couple other players, you know, we talked a lot about Rocco Grimaldi, and deservedly so. He's been phenomenal for this team all year long. But, you know, on his flank, well, I guess he was on the wing, but the two other players on his line this weekend, you know, Milwaukee might have found themselves a new first line. They've been juggling with the top six all year. You know, Cole Smith and Matt Luff and Tommy Novak have kind of traded call-ups. Right now, Matt Luff's in Nashville with Nick Cousins injured. So the top line this game or this weekend was Afanasyev, Novak, and Rocco Grimaldi. They scored all three goals on Friday against Texas. I also tracked that line's both their games this weekend, but particularly on Friday, they were unbelievable at even strength. In against the Stars, Tommy Novak had a 74.1% Corsi. Rocco Grimaldi had a 70.8% Corsi, and Igor Afanasyev had a 69.6% Corsi. Nice. On Friday night, yes. So
that is a dominant possession performance.
Yeah.
Real quick, for those of our listeners who have not quite made it through all of episode zero yet, Corsi is basically your the percentage of shots that your team is attempting while you're on the ice versus the number of the shots that the other team is attempting on the ice. So you want higher numbers because that means your team has the puck, they're attempting shots, you can't attempt shots without the puck. So having anything over 50 is good. The further from 50 you are, the better or worse it is, depending on what direction you're going. So yes, 70%, that's a unsustainable amount for a season, but for one game, that is a dominant game.
Go ahead, Eric. They Texas couldn't get the puck off their sticks on Friday. And it showed, like I said, they contributed at all three goals. And I think it was a really important weekend for Afanasyev and Novak. You know, Novak, people forget he started the year in Nashville. COVID, I think, really hit him hard. When he went back to Milwaukee, I think he struggled in a few games, and we weren't seeing the player who I think was one of the best centers in the league last year when he played for Chicago. And the past few games, we've you know, started to see the Tommy Novak of old, which has been great. You know, not the fastest, but he's got great hands. He's a great playmaker at even strength and on the power play. And for Afanasyev, you know, I think he's a fan favorite in Nashville, but truth be told, he's had his struggles this year, as you would expect in a player's first year in the AHL. He's had his ups and downs. You know, he shoots the puck a lot. He's not that far down the scoring list on the team, but, you know, he's been scratched a few times. He's been playing on the fourth line. He's been struggling to use his feet to carry the puck into the offensive zone. He's not been getting a ton of high-danger shot attempts all season. So to have a weekend like this on the top line, get the first goal against Texas, I think it's a real big confidence boost. And, you know, if he can kind of continue that down the stretch, then that's a real added benefit for this Milwaukee club.
I have your answer about the penalties. So currently in time shorthanded per game, Milwaukee has 4.218. They are sixth in the AHL. At Christmas time, though, they were averaging, 4.889. They were second in the AHL. So like you said, personal growth. Funny enough, the two teams that are leading the league now in time shorthanded per game were first and third back at Christmas. That is Abbotsford and Henderson. Mm.
Yay, Pacific Division.
Yeah, definitely been a wild one out there. It really has been a little bit of a return to, as you called it, the Wild West. But it's, I don't know. I definitely agree that there have been really good nights from Rocco Grimaldi, obviously. But Matt Luff has been someone who's kind of surprised me this year. I was definitely not expecting him to be this good, or him to kind of find such a natural place in the order of the team. Like, he was one that I thought, I don't want to say wouldn't fit in, but would get buried and not have kind of the ability to kind of showcase what he can do. Because he is, he can drive play, but he's better when he is a support player. And everyone, like, I think that is something that people like slag guys for, and they're like, oh yeah, but he doesn't drive play. I'm like, how many cooks do you think need to be in this kitchen? Like, yeah. You need support guys on your roster. You know, every line needs someone who's just digging pucks out of the corner or finding soft ice in the slot, or if nothing else, just dragging defenders away from, you know, a passing lane that you find. Like, yeah. You need guys that can do that. And Matt Luff has been that, even though he's not the fleetest of foot. And Milwaukee has, you know, one or two guys that have wheels. I mean, they traded Tony Rick, who that does seem to be working out for them a little bit, though. Yeah. I was surprised by that.
Huntington's been all right. I mean, Huntington's not particularly slow either. He's not Anthony Richard fast, but who is in this league? Yeah. I love Anthony Richard. Ever since the Preds drafted him, I think I've been excited about him as a player. As much as it hurts to see him go, I mean, it's clear he had a really good season last year, a real good rebound year for Chicago. But I mean, that roster was like nearly an all-star team. So, but the year before that and this year, he's really struggling. And it was clear that the organization was done with him. You know, I talked to Carl Taylor at the beginning of the year and I asked, is it a make or break year for Anthony Richard? And I kind of expected him to, you know, have more of a ringing endorsement and say, no, you know, the organization's behind him. And he basically was like, basically said, yeah, it is. And I think he knows that and think he knows what he needs to do. So it's a tough pill to swallow, but you know, truthfully, probably Milwaukee wasn't going to get anything more out of him than they had. And yeah. By the way, it seems like we're heading down that path with Frederick Allard as well. Although I will maintain that Frederick Allard has much more to give than Anthony Richard does.
That's fair. And I think some of it too is finding guys that fit your timeline. Like Anthony Richard was not someone who was going to fit what is probably Nashville's last grasp at a competitive window here before they have to either retool or start over. Probably retool, but like
with the contracts they have on the books.
Yeah.
Like you have a hard time starting over.
Yeah. Yeah. But like, it's one of those where like, I remember when Anthony Mantha got traded from the Red Wings. People are like, but Mantha's really good. Why do the Red Wings trade him? I'm like, because they're not going to be competitive for another two or three seasons. And by that time, Mantha is going to be at the back years of his prime. Like, you trade that guy to, you know, let him go chase, you know, glory somewhere else, but to find more pieces that will be ready for your window to compete. And like, I don't agree that, I think Anthony Richard still has a lot left to give a team, but like, he's not going to fit with the competitive window of Nashville right now. And as much as that sucks for him, like, he's done really well in Syracuse for what I've seen. We covered them last week, and the line with, I think it was him, Barry Boulay, and Jemel Smith just was on fire. Like, they could do no wrong. So he definitely needs to be finding a home in Syracuse as it is. So that's at least good for him. I think next year.
Go ahead.
I think next year is probably going to be the year that Connor Ingram finally gets the chance to be the backup to UC Saros.
He'll be in Nashville, definitely.
I mean,
it's a pretty much a guarantee at this point.
Yeah, because I know that every time I see David Rittich is starting, I'm running to my computer to bet against Nashville. So
it's funny that both teams are in a position, Nashville and Milwaukee, where I think David Rittich is fine. Like, they just don't play him enough, which is going to probably bite them, but like, both in a position where they're overworking their starting goalie in Nashville and Milwaukee this season.
Oh, Milwaukee for sure. And like, I think Rittich is a very passable starting goaltender, but like, the team is much more like UC Saros a Vezina candidate goaltender. Yeah. You could send him to like a league average guy. And it's like, oh yeah, suddenly this is now a much bigger, you know, a much bigger deal for the other team shooting on them. And like, I think Devin Cooley, you know, probably could be a reasonable backup goaltender at the AHL level. Like the gap between Saros and Rittich and Cooley and Ingram is not the same. But like, I don't think Cooley sucks, but Maka doesn't suck either. But
I want it noted, CC and I both had the same reaction.
I said could be a, you know, like.
Well, you better start getting there because I've yet to see it.
I don't know. I've seen some good games from him, but like, yeah. He's definitely not what Connor Ingram gives that team, which is the ability to just straight up steal games for them when they play like crap in front of him, which I mean, him, he's going to be in our end season awards ballots for goaltender of the year. I mean, unless he falls off a giant cliff, which seems unlikely. It's pretty much going to be him and the goaltenders that do the same thing where it's, you know, them carrying their team, kicking and screaming to the finish line in some games. And I think all of them are in the Central too. Calvin Pickard for Grand Rapids, Arvid Soderblom for Rockford. Like, it's the three of them and...
Isn't what's his name in Henderson?
Logan Thompson.
Yeah.
Like, I thought Logan Thompson had like no shot to stay in Vegas. They were going to run the tandem of Brissant and Lehner, and that was going to be it. And that was what was going to keep him in Henderson and keep him, you know, just racking up stats. But like, he's gotten time in Vegas, and not that he hasn't earned it, and he's looked reasonable in that time. So like, I mean, I'm happy for him, but yeah, I don't think he's going to have the same level of resume that the other two will, just by sheer not as many starts. Like, he definitely belongs in that conversation, but he's played like I think half the games, half the minutes they have. And
yeah,
at some point, you know, your resume of just body of work or volume of work rather is going to matter. So
Colorado is who I was thinking of, actually.
Oh yeah, and Eustace Annunen's played a ridiculous amount of minutes too, but he's been fine in them, but he has not been. I mean,
he's not Conor Ingram. Yeah,
he's batting league average. CeCe, don't shake your head. Don't.
I'm not shaking. I went from side to side. I was not shaking my head. It's just some games I'm like, okay, he's getting the North American game down. And other games I'm like, what are you doing? But anyway, Eric, okay. I had one last question for you before we look forward on the Milwaukee Admirals schedule. So, I was thinking to myself, would it be nice to have some brotherly action with Colorado and Milwaukee, you know, a few weeks back? And I said, sure would. He for sure would. Cole sure would.
It's terrible. It's so bad.
Mark that down as another editing moment.
No. We're keeping that in there. I did not get to see Kiefer and Cole Sherwood in Colorado when I did catch that game. So we're going to focus on Cole Sherwood here. Late November, you know, Milwaukee trades with Belleville. Belleville's like, hey, you got any more of those future considerations? And Milwaukee's like, I got you, man. I got you. So they bring Cole Sherwood in. I know he hasn't played. He's played about 15 games, you know, just as much as he played for Belleville this season. But Cole Sherwood, is he making a positive impact? I mean, beyond the score sheet and everything like that. And, you know, what are your thoughts on him?
Yeah, I mean, well, you're right. We hadn't seen him. So he had got hurt and it was the beginning of the year. And he just came back, not this past weekend, but the weekend before, I think, against, when they play Colorado. So we haven't seen a lot of him. You know, so this past weekend, he was on a line with Cody Glass and Cole Schneider, which I think was good. Again, three players who are not particularly fast. I think Sherwood's probably the quickest of the bunch. Cole Schneider and Cody Glass are number two and number three on Milwaukee's scoring table. So they're obviously doing something right. And he looked good. I think, you know, he's probably just getting his feet back under him. You know, there wasn't much before the injury to really – you know, glean anything from, but I will say of the 5 points he scored in Milwaukee, four of them have been primary points at even strength. So that's a positive. And I am excited to see, you know, if Matloff is up in Nashville longer, or even if, you know, he trades spots with Cole Smith or whoever, you know, if Sherwood can kind of develop a more permanent role in that top six, what can happen here down the stretch, because they really need, a border, you know, the threshold between the second and the third line to start scoring, whether it's him, Cole Smith has been playing well, but whether it's him, whether it's Huntington, whether it's Graham Knott, they really need to get something going there. So
I think the other thing, too, that definitely plays outside of Milwaukee's favor here is that come playoff time, you know, the Hurricanes, like who Chicago has in the roster right now, that is pretty much their playoff roster. Mm-hmm. Who Milwaukee has on their roster right now is pretty much their playoff roster. Winnipeg is going to send a buttload of talent back to Manitoba.
Yeah.
And so is Chicago going to be sending guys back to Rockford. So, and like, I mean, Detroit's not making the playoffs. So should Grand Rapids sneak in, they'll have talent. So like in that instance, it's starting to become, like you said, we start to need to see, you know, your bottom depth scoring, because it's not like they're going to get an influx of talent from Nashville, or at least hopefully not. Hopefully Nashville makes it through the first round, but they're not going to have that big influx of talent coming back to them, whereas other teams are. So they're going to need the guys that they have on that roster to be going heading into the end of the season in the last little bit here.
Yeah. I will note, though, two players slash three or four players who could be coming to Milwaukee later in the season, sooner than later in Jakim Kondalik from UConn and Spencer Stastny from Notre Dame. Notre Dame's going to make the tournament, but you know, depending how far they go, we'll see. Juuso Parsonen over in Finland, once TPS the season ends, he's going to be coming over. And, you know, this team has Memorial Cup aspirations, so may not matter, but Luke Evangelista will be in the AHL next season. And should London have an early departure from the playoffs, could be on its way to Milwaukee.
This is exactly why we need to have guys like you on, because like I have enough time trying to cover this league on its own, like knowing the, you know, leagues of other pro, like that's, see, that yeah. was
Luke Evangelista, who odd has 42 goals in 43 games in London this year.
And he played a little bit in the AHL last year, didn't he?
He did.
He played 14 games for Chicago. And he admitted this himself. He was totally underwater.
But I think like as much as those experiences probably sucked, I think they were really helpful for him just to have that, like, because when you're somebody who's just dunking on junior leagues at that level, like it becomes a point where it's like, this is actually detrimental to me, because now I feel like I have this big false sense of how good I am. And then I remember those AHL days where I was, you know, like a lost puppy. Like that's as much.
He really hadn't had that season in juniors yet, because his first year at London, he barely played. His second year, you know, got on the board a lot more scoring wise, but it wasn't, you know, a point per game season by any stretch. And then he went to the AHL, not till basically the end of the year. And, you know, I spoke to him actually that year, and he used it as motivation, and, you know, he made him realize how much more he needed to work on getting stronger in his shot and in his skating. And, you know, like I said, leading goal scorer in the OHL now. So,
you know, very tacit support for, we should throw out the NHL-CHL agreement, just saying.
Or at least have some sort of
some amendments, something.
Agreed.
We've beaten that thing to death already. All right. Let's see. Let's start looking forward here. Milwaukee heads to a 3-4 as they play a Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, all at home in Panther Arena. Wednesday's game is a school day game at 10:30 in the morning against the Iowa Wild. The Admirals are 5-2 against the Wild this season, having won the last four. Iowa has slipped to 6 in the Central and is 3-7 in their last 10 games. They are 29th in the AHL in road game win percentage as well. So hopefully they get, you know, their Keurig on the right timer, so they're up in time for a 10:30 game. I could never imagine doing that as a professional hockey player. Friday's game is Rockford at a normal time at 7 p.m. Or is against Rockford. It's still in Milwaukee at 7 p.m. The Admirals have split their 8 meetings so far with Rockford, 4-4. The road team has won 6 of the 8 games in the Admirals Ice Hawks season series. Rockford has the weekdays off this week, so they'll have a slight rest advantage going into that game. They're on a skid right now, though, having lost 4 of their last 5. Saturday's game is against the Chicago Wolves. The Admirals are 2-7 against the Wolves this season, but the Admirals have won the last 2 games between them. Chicago will have a rest advantage here as they're playing the second game of a 3-5. Well, this is the third game of the Admirals for the weekend. For the week, rather. The Wolves have won 4 of their last 5, so they're coming in hot. Eric, any parting thoughts here on the Milwaukee Admirals before we go to break and send you on your way?
Yeah, I think one thing, we kind of touched on him earlier, in Devin Cooley, and I mean, like, he has struggled most of the year. And there's a reason Connor Ingram has started, like, 70% of the Admirals games. But they don't need, like, all-star level goaltending from him. And I think he can deliver what they need when he's in net. On Sunday against Grand Rapids, 28 saves on 30 shots, I think. He looked really good for the most part. If Milwaukee can get performances from him on the nights he's in the net like that, That's going to go a long way to A, giving Connor Ingram a bit of a break, and B, giving this team more confidence when Connor Ingram is on the bench. And that's going to be helpful down the stretch. A little over 20 games to go. I'm going to guess Ingram starts 15 or more of them. But, you know, in those ones where he's not a confident, Devin Cooley can go a long way for this team.
Also, side note, Devin Cooley, actually all three Admirals goaltenders that have kind of jumped in there this season. Ingram,
okay, Parker Gahagan played like one game.
Oh, I was thinking Vimaka.
He hasn't played yet.
Oh, he hasn't played? I thought
He dressed for one game, but he was the backup.
Yeah. All three of them have sweet masks. Like A-plus goalie art there. I'm pretty sure a couple of them are going to be sneaking into our award show as well. Well, thank you very much, Eric, for coming on the show. Please tell our listeners where they can find you and your work on the internet.
Sure. You can find all my writing, including about the Admirals, at ontheforecheck.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at onthefutureotf for updates on the Admirals and all Preds prospects.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us today. We're going to take a break here. After the break, we will get to San Jose. If you're just here from Milwaukee, thank you for stopping by. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you're listening to us from so you get episodes in a timely fashion. Also, check us out on social media where we have a lot of fun. We do some memes. Links to all of that and more can be found on our Linktree page at linktr.ee/TheCalderFarmstead. We're going to pay some bills, run some ads. We will be right back. Stay tuned.
We are on our last deep dive series over in the Pacific Division, of course, the Best Coast. And we're going to be talking about the San Jose Barracuda, who have, of course, struggled this season, last place in the Pacific Division and all that. They played at Stockton on Saturday, 6 p.m. and Sunday at 5 p.m. versus Tucson, hosting the Roadrunners. Saturday and Sunday, Sean, we had some goals. Let's talk about those goals. Why don't you talk about those goals?
All right. Saturday, Adam Raska gives the puck away in the defensive zone, and the Heat work the puck to the point. Kevin Gravel goes D-to-D to Nick DeSimone, who dekes past Nick Merkley, moves towards the slot, and fires a wrister that Luke Philp gets a tip on. 1-0 Heat, just 3:50 into the game. A blown defensive coverage by the Barracuda leaves Walker Dewar alone on an island in front of the net. Emilio Peterson one-touches a rim around from the point to the slot for Dewar. He one-times it for a Heat goal, 2-0 Heat, with 9:23 left in the first period. The Cuda catch the Heat napping in the neutral zone as they get a 3-on-2 rush. Sasha Shimlevsky passes to Dylan Hamlick. Hamlick gains the zone, turns the corner past Jonas Schindvall, and finds Shimlevsky at the top of the crease. Shimlevsky taps it in to bring the Cuda back within one with 9:56 in the second period. Montana Onyebuchi steps up to make a hit in the neutral zone, but springs the Heat 2-on-0 behind him. Luke Philp passes across Railroad to Emilio Peterson for the easy 2-on-0 goal. 3-1 Heat with just under 3 minutes left in the second period. Nazeev breaks up a clearing attempt by the Heat and walks down the wall in the Cuda offensive zone. He catches the Heat puck watching and finds Dylan Hamiluk on the back door for an easy tap-in. The Cuda are back within one with 17:05 left in the third period. Lane Peterson breaks up a rush chance for the Heat and the Cuda in the Cuda defensive zone with a good stick and springs the Cuda on a 3-on-1 counterattack. John Leonard walks in and beats Dustin Wolf 5-hole on an absolute Wild West stare down snipe. How many guys can do that? Tie game at 3 with 5:45 left in the third period. John Leonard does, however, get us to, or sorry, we do get to overtime though here, as a regulation does not give us a winner. John Leonard makes a bad change in that overtime as the Heat have a rush chance going the other way. Matthew Phillips enters the Cuda zone, drives down the wall, and pulls up to find Yusso Valimaki wide open as a trailer because John Leonard's change was late and his replacement can't get there in time. Valimaki rips the wrister that beats Melnichuk for the win. Heat 4-3 in overtime. Sunday, wow. Very different story. Jan Janik walks into the Cuda offensive zone and passes to Hudson Fashing along the left half wall. Fashing fires a pass across Railroad to Michael Carconi. Carconi collects the pass and rips the wrister that beats Zach Amond. 1-0 Roadrunners, just 3:42 into the game. Joachim Blickfeld picks off a pass in the offensive zone and sets up John Leonard in the slot. Leonard's shot is stopped by Prosvetov, but the rebound is coughed up by the Roadrunners. Leonard finds it and rips a backhand past Prosvetov. Tie game at 1, 12:20 left in the first. On the power play, Lane Peterson gets a pass across Royal Road to John Leonard. Leonard tries to make a pass to the slot for Weinger, but it deflects off Cam Crotty's skate. Lane Peterson grabs the loose puck and puts it into a wide open net. 2-1 Barracuda, 10:37 left in the second period. A pass from Imama to LaCroix bounces to the point where Matt Foley collects it and wrists one from distance that somehow beats Zach Amond. Regardless, it's a tie game at 2 with 17:34 left in the third period. But the Cuda just blow the game open at that point. On a breakout in the Roadrunners' defensive zone, Doyle Summerby looks to pass to Cole Holtz, but Holtz is going off for a line change. Dylan Hamluck scoops up the loose puck and passes to Nick Merkley in the slot. Merkley wrists one past Prosbatov to retake the lead 3-2 with 14:53 left in the third. Mid-line change, the Barracuda gain the zone on the power play. The Roadrunners get caught puck-watching and don't scan to find where the Barracuda are as they come in onto the ice. Nick Merkley takes advantage, finds Blickfeld across Royal Road. Blickfeld snaps a one-timer over Prosvetov's shoulder, 4-2 Cuda, 7:31 left in the third. The Cuda catch the Roadrunners over-pursuing on the forecheck, spring an odd man rush the other way. Lane Peterson comes in 2-on-1 with John Leonard. He sauces a pass across Royal Road to Leonard for a one-timer that Prosvetov can't come up with. 5-2 Cuda, a little over three minutes left in the third. 4-on-4, John Leonard wins a foot race to a puck in the neutral zone over Ben Wings McCartney. Prosvetov tries to poke check him. Leonard deeks around him and roofs one. 6-2 Barracuda, which would be your final score.
Yeah, quite a different game than that close encounter with Stockton that they had the night before. To the picks. Courtney had it backwards. She said San Jose would beat Stockton. That's a bold strategy, Cotton. It didn't seem to work out for her. And then also said that San Jose would lose to Tucson. So incorrect on both of those picks, unfortunately, for Court. Sean, you said you would take the Heat, but San Jose would bounce back over Tucson. Oh, yeah. Now I'm doing the Hulk Hogan pose with the Macho Man voice. We must be getting closer to cream of the crop. Model said Stockton is a 59.6% favorite on Saturday, and then San Jose with the 56.5% favorite on Sunday. It's only a model, but it is correct. So there you go. Two games against two teams with two very different results. Let's talk Saturday's games first, of course. It looks like the Barracuda almost upset a very good Stockton team on the road. How close were they to really pulling this upset off, Sean?
I mean, in reality, they were a shot away in overtime from a win here. well, in sure. Watching the game, though, they were far and away the second best team on the ice in Stockton. But this is a Cuda team that has been stripped down pretty good, especially on defense. The Sharks currently have four defensemen on the IR right now: Carlson, Ferraro, Kinishov, and Megna. That means the Cuda are playing guys on defense who definitely don't belong at this level. And yeah, that's what it looks like. The Cuda breakouts are sloppy and mistake-filled because breakouts typically start with a defenseman collecting a dump-in or a rebound or a loose puck, reading the pressure and making a pass. And none of the Cuda's bottom four defensemen in Cisic, Moberg, Holloway, or Onyebuchi can do those things well on a regular basis. They were pretty horrific at that this weekend. And from, you know, what I've gathered from the rest of their season, it's been a pretty regular occurrence for them to be terrible at that. And as we've said many a times, if you can't get the puck out of your zone in a controlled manner in transition, you're going to have a bad time. And it's another reason that their power play breakouts also work a lot better than their 5-on-5 breakouts is that you don't have a lot of forechecking pressure to deal with in your own end 5-on-4. Pretty much usually a dump in, and you have all day to kind of move the puck up the ice. So the deficiency of the Sharks' decor and having to have poise under pressure, field pucks cleanly off the back wall, and kind of make those passes under pressure is largely hidden because those situations don't happen when they're up a man. Stockton took advantage of those turnovers, though, that their D made in a big way and created a lot of offense from that and from the Cuda's D zone play and bad plays on the Cuda breakouts. The Barracuda do have some offensive talent though, which even in this kind of stinker of a season should not go unpraised. When the Cuda can get the puck moving in transition, they're at least an average team on offense and can produce. I also want to say credit to Alexei Melnichuk for playing a pretty decent game there. Yeah, he let up 4 goals, but he was under fire all night and his stats this season look bad, but a very healthy portion of that is the league's worst defensive environment in front of him. So I am not willing to just throw away Melnichuk's season, because as we've talked about at least a little bit on this podcast, you can tell he does not trust the defense in front of him. And when you don't trust your defense, you start to cheat as if your defense are not going to do your job. And shooters in even the American League are too good. When they see you start to lean the other way off your post, they will find that space. And that's where you see kind of what's been going on with the Cuda this year. Those goaltenders do not trust those defensemen in front of them to, you know, take care of their responsibilities. And there's merit in that, because, man, they really don't do the job that they're supposed to. And your goalie is cheating. The shooters see that. And then it's just a pick'em of, do you put it past the defenseman who's not doing his job for a backdoor tap-in, or do you put it past the goalie who's giving you space because he expects you to do that?
Yeah, we were forewarned by our good friend Kevin Lacey, who covers the Barracuda there down in the Bay Area, that their defense was terabad, horror awful, and saw it this weekend. But, I mean, yeah, with an 11th-ranked power play in the AHL, I mean, there is an offensive upside to San Jose. And I mean, when you can't score six goals, even against the woeful Tucson Roadrunners, if your offense isn't at least somewhat able to do so, you know, somewhat has that ability.
Also, no power plays for them against Stockton. Stockton took, I think they took a fighting major, and that was it. That was the only called penalty in the entire game.
Wow. See, and that just baffles me. Like, I've encountered, there was a Milwaukee game that we covered last segment that had no penalties. You know, there was no power play opportunities for the Admirals against Texas. It's like, I don't know how that can happen.
I will say, watching this San Jose Stockton game, it was not a very scrappy affair. Like, there wasn't any, you know, this isn't like a prison rules game here. Like, the fact that there weren't any penalties was surprising, or weren't any power plays given. I think there was one fighting major in the game. So,
right.
The obvious call there. But, like, there really wasn't a whole lot of, like, man, how did the ref miss? Like, I really didn't see anything egregious that was let slide by the officials. So,
gotcha.
Like, it's a weird occurrence, but I don't feel like it was wrong here. And
okay,
you know, if someone saw a penalty that they missed, you want a screenshot and tweet at us, I'll take the L if that's the case. But like, I really can't, I don't have anything in my notes of blown call on so-and-so, or, you know, that was a makeup call or a makeup non-call, or like, really not a lot of, you know, much going on. It looked like a very clean game to me.
Okay.
So,
well, I did kind of foreshadow it talking about San Jose's offensive capability with the six goals. So let's talk about Sunday's game against Tucson. They did pick up that sizable win against the Roadrunners. What went so right for them in this game after coming so close to beating the Stockton Heat in overtime the previous game?
I mean, this game was pretty much tailor-made for a Cuda home win. It combines the things that the Cuda are bad at that wouldn't be exploited with things that they are good at that they could exploit. The Cuda are bad at killing penalties. They're bad at transition. And with Matias Michelli in a Coyotes jersey this weekend, the Roadrunners power play is significantly less threatening. How much less threatening? Well, Michelli leads the Roadrunners with 28 power play points this season. That leads the team. Second and third on the team are Carconi and Jan Jenik, who have combined 31 power play points this season. So the two of them combined are 2 points better than Michelli. That's how big of a difference maker he is. That power play runs through him. Tucson also is not a great forechecking team, and also has a depleted roster because the Coyotes have six guys on IR. And are pretty actively taking a tank approach to this season. So the Roadrunners themselves have also been beaten up for most of the season too, in terms of roster depth. Not that it was great to start the year. But Tucson to keep in this game for two periods because of a lot of the same problems the Cuda had with their defensemen and breakouts that Stockton exploited. But they at least managed to get some transition going in the second and third periods. Unlike Stockton, who didn't take a single penalty in this game against Barracuda, Tucson sent the Cuda power play to work. And if there is one thing we can say works for certain on this team, it's the power play. We highlighted it in the preview. The power play works, and it works damn good. And that's another big story of that.
Well, you've started mentioning some individual player names, so let's dive in and do it officially. What are some other names and players that stood out to you this weekend for the Barracuda, Tucson, Stockton?
I mean, we're just going to stick to Barracuda here.
Okay. That's fair.
I don't like to drag other teams into, you know, one team's preview. Let them have the spotlight here. We'll start with the obvious ones. Sasha Shymlewski, just all around very good player. His entry level deal is up at the end of the season, and I could see the Sharks struggle to figure out what to do with him. I think he's an NHLer, but probably doesn't have a top six ceiling. But I definitely do think there is space for him in the bottom six. He's better than a fair number of fourth liners across the league currently, but he looked real good this weekend. John Leonard has a rocket ship for a shot. That one bad line change in overtime aside, which I feel like is a little results oriented. Like, it didn't look like the worst line change when he made it, but it seemed like the bench was slow to kind of figure out what was going on. And his guy was the one that scored. So yeah, that's not a great look for him, but the rest of the time, I mean, he was a weapon on the ice. Not a lot of guys can beat goalies cleanly like he did at the AHL level. Like, he straight up stared down Dustin Wolf, who is going to be on the ballot for best goaltender for us this season. Whether or not he wins is another story, but he will be on the ballot. And for you to just stare him down, whites of the eyes, Wild West style, and rip a pass five hole on him, or rip a shot five hole past him, that's shooting talent. Like, guys do not just do that to a goaltender of Dustin Wolf's caliber. One-on-one, stare down, he sees the shot the whole way, kind of like. I think he's another like Shymlewski where he should be getting time in the NHL, but I don't think his skill set is quite as well-rounded as Sasha's, where he's a lot like, if he plays bottom 4 minutes, I don't think that's a good fit for him at the NHL level. I think he has a higher ceiling and he has two-way capability to him, but what he's best at does not suit itself to, you know, a fourth line, energy line, kill penalties kind of role. He's someone who needs, I would say, middle 6 minutes, power play two time to really be effective in the NHL and carve out a role. And I don't know if the Sharks are ready to give him that. I think they maybe should try, but it doesn't seem like that's the path for him right now. If he ends up doing another year in San Jose or for the Barracuda, I think that's fine. But I think he could crack an NHL roster right now. Artem Nazev is someone who definitely has decent raw tools, but struggled with how his game is translated from the juniors to the AHL. A jump, you know, juniors or college to the AHL is one that we've said in the past many, many times is typically the biggest hurdle for prospects, you know, going from playing guys who are your age or younger or who are, you know, not going to be professional hockey players to playing grown-ass men that do this for a living and have for a long time that are bigger and stronger and probably at least as fast as you is a big hurdle for those players coming in. And it's definitely been one for Artemi Nazev. But he definitely has some flashes of higher end playmaking vision, good offensive abilities. However, he's not great defensively and made a couple of turnovers in transition or kind of lost his coverage. And it was eye opening. So there's enough raw talent there for me to see a path to the NHL for him, but it's one that's going to take a far amount of seasoning in the NHL. And it's just a path. He still has to walk it. He still has to develop. The tools are there, but how you wield them counts for a lot. I already mentioned the other bottom four defensemen for the CUDA, so I don't see the need to pile onto them here, but they probably should not be in the AHL. They definitely should not be playing middle pairing minutes in the AHL. But here we are, giving them middle pairing roles in the AHL, and shockingly bad things are happening in that with that choice. I think that's about it for the CUDA for this weekend here. At least That's looking in the rearview mirror. Let's look forward, CC. Where do the CUDA go from here?
San Jose. They have a classic Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, 3-4 upcoming. At Ontario on Wednesday at 7 p.m. Pacific. 0-4 against the Rain this season. Not a big surprise there. The Rain are 8-2 in their last 10 games, and they have won 5 straight. It's Ontario, Stockton, and seemingly everybody else in the Pacific Division. Friday in San Jose at 7 p.m., the Friday-Saturday home-and-home with Stockton. So they're going to be in San Jose, California at 7 on Friday. Saturday in Stockton at 6 p.m. 1-4 against the Heat this season. The Heat are 7-3 in their last 10 games as well. Again, Ontario and Stockton and seemingly everybody else currently. Not to say that those aren't bad teams in the middle of the Pacific Division, but Ontario and Stockton, they good. They real good. So good luck, San Jose. Godspeed. Stay nasty.
All right. We are going to take a break here. After the break, we will get to the cream of the crop, the best players from the weekend. If you're just here for San Jose, thank you for stopping by. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you're listening to us from so you get episodes in a timely fashion. They will be a little less timely in the upcoming weeks, but we'll get to that later. Also, make sure you check us out on social media where we have fun, we do memes, we make Sean Avery jokes. Links to all of that and more can be found in our Linktree page at linktr.ee/TheCalderFarmstead. We're going to pay some bills, run some ads. We will be right back. Stay tuned.
Oh, yeah. It's time for the madness here on the Calder Farmstead. Oh, get ready for some cream if you're lactose intolerant. I got to warn you because it's time for the cream of the crop. Nobody does it better than me and Mr. Sean O'Brien over there. I'll tell you what. All right, we're going to get started. We're going to take it easy. We're not going to knock the pop filter or the microphone over. We already did that. Now we're going to calm down. We're going to pick our three best players in the AHL from the past weekend. Mr. O'Brien, why don't you do it? Yeah.
My first pick for cream of the crop is Victor Brattstrom, Grand Rapids Griffins, a 35-save shutout. First start in over 2 weekends for the Griffins for Brattstrom, and he balls out. 35-save shutout. That's not easy work. That's not a light night to be stopping pucks. Victor Brattstrom is my third cream of the crop for the weekend. CeCe, who is number three for you?
Number three. That's a great number. 3 days. Robbie Payne from the Cleveland Monsters, all aboard the Payne train. Yeah. Primary assist in the opening goal plus 2 goals in the third period. Let me tell you, that helped the Monsters defeat the Toronto Marlies 4-2 on Saturday. Man, the basement dwelling Cleveland Monsters took out the second place team in the North Division. Robbie Payne on the Payne train. You add an assist on a Tyler Sekura goal the next night. And there you have cream of the crop, numero tres, bilingual macho. Yeah.
All right. Well, I see you're upset of the Marlies, and I give you a player from the Marlies win, Curtis Douglas from the Toronto Marlies, a 1-goal, 3-assist, 4-point effort, all primary points, powered the Marlies to an 8-5 absolute boat race over the Monsters. You put up 4 points in a game, you're going to show up on cream of the crop for us. And that's where he is at cream of the crop. My second cream of the crop for the weekend. CeCe, who is numero dos for you?
Oh, I see what you did there, Shawnee. Number two, numero dos, little Espanol, but Jack Drury from the Chicago Wolves. He had a secondary assist against Texas in Saturday's winning effort. Then he drops a hat trick on Iowa as the Wolves defeated the Wild 5-3 on Sunday. So much talent on the Wolves, it's like the mega powers exploding. Wow. Freak out. Chicago Wolves, Jack Drury, my second cream of the crop. Nobody does it better except for my first cream of the crop. Yeah.
For me, my first cream of the crop, we talked about him in our last segment, and we'll give him a pass on that overtime line change, but John Leonard from the San Jose Barracuda, 4 goals, 1 assist, 5 points on the weekend, a hat trick that powered the win over the Roadrunners. They couldn't have done it without him. That is my top of the cream of the crop, John Leonard from the San Jose Barracuda. Macho CeCe, who does it for you?
My number one, it's going to be up in Rochester, New York. Yeah, I've wrestled in plenty of matches there in Rochester back in the 80s and the territory days. Yeah, but Arttu Ruotsalainen, the man scores 2 goals in 3 straight games. And with that third game coming on Friday against Belleville, Ruotsalainen tallied the game-tying goal in the third period. It was a beauty. And the game-winning goal in overtime to lift the Amerks. Rising up, lift him up, body slam him right to the mat. Peace ends. 3-2 victory for Rochester, and you add an assist and a losing effort on Saturday, but that's all right. The man's got 9 points in his last four games. He's feeling it, and he's on his way, if you know what I mean. Get Sensational Sherry by his side, accompany him down to the ice, give him some theme music, some fireworks. Ruotsalainen, yeah! My first cream of the crop. Nobody does it better, and I mean it this time.
All right.
All right.
We unfortunately do not have a quiz this weekend. The weekend was too fun. I did not get around to it. We will find a way to work a quiz into one of these future shows, because I realize that is some fun that we usually have and haven't for the last couple of weeks. That's on me. I make the quizzes. I am the quiz master. I apologize for that. We will be returning to your usually scheduled quizzes in short order sometime in the future. CC, lead us out.
Will do. That is it for the show. Thank you for watching and or listening. The Calder Farmstead is part of the Full Press Radio Network. You can listen to this and several other great hockey, sports, and pro wrestling programs or sports entertainment if you're the WWE. But nevertheless, you can listen to all those shows at fullpresscoverage.com. Just click the podcast drop-down menu in the top right portion of the website. And you can enjoy a multitude of different topics. And with that in mind, with all that good stuff out there, we always appreciate you tuning in here on TCF.
And if you guys are enjoying the Calder Farmstead, please make sure you subscribe so you get episodes in a timely fashion. Also, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon, or one of the other ones that I'm assuming is just selling your information to, you know, a foreign government. If they have rating and review stuff, just click the 5-star button, you know, type nice words about us. We'd really appreciate it. Doing so helps others find the show. Your reviews help us improve it. You can also follow the show on social media at Calder Farmstead on Twitter, at The Calder Farmstead on Instagram and Facebook. Links to all of that and more can be found on our Linktree page, which is at linktr.ee/TheCalderFarmstead. Big thanks to Adrian Drake, who made our theme music. You can find him on social media at AD_dysfunction. That's AD_DYSFUNCTION. So he can make music for you too. CeCe, where can the people find you?
Well, my name is CeCe Hockley. You can find me representing Full Press Hockey on Twitter at FPC_AHL. All the latest AHL news. Try and keep that up to date on that handle. You can also follow me on my personal Twitter account at CCHawk. That's SeeSeeHawk. A little cheeky there. But yeah, mainly about hockey. But I tweet about music, films, other stuff. Hopefully, if it keeps me interested, it is not going to be bullshit for you. Check out my writing on the Full Press Coverage Network at fullpresshockey.com. Myself and my wonderful AHL team of writers there. Check it all out if you would. But enough about me, enough about that. Sean, where can the people find you?
I'm Sean O'Brien. You can find me on Twitter at SeanO'Brien81. That's SeanO'Brien81. I'm also on Instagram at SeanO'Brien_81. Both are personal accounts, but have different kind of tastes to them. My Twitter is mostly hockey like CC's, but there's also random musings, Gordle scores, that kind of thing. My Instagram is like 80% dog pictures. My dog is adorable, but she knows it. You can find my stats work on Tableau at bit.ly/data-dump-and-chase. All lowercase, all one word. CeCe, it's 2 minutes to midnight. Take us home.
The hands they threaten to. That'll do it for episode number 89 of the Calder Farmstead. For Sean O'Brien, I'm Bruce Dickinson. Just kidding, I'm CeCe Hockley. I do not have a voice like Iron Maiden's Bruce Dickinson. So with that said, we bid you adieu. And as always, keep your stick on the ice.